Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This weekend, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, one of the world's richest individuals, took a big step and changed his status by marrying his college sweetheart. And he also took his company public in one of the most anticipated stock offerings in Wall Street history. Joining us now is Sarah Kessler. Sarah writes about entrepreneurs, emerging technology trends, and education, politics, and fun for the social media blog site Mashable. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Question for our listeners. Anybody out there, did you buy stock in Facebook? Were you able to get through to buy stock in Facebook? Would you, if you had the chance, do it over again? Or are you glad you didn't get through and weren't able to buy the stock? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're on Facebook, and you can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. So, Sarah, Facebook shares were down 12% midday yesterday, well below the offering price, and it raised questions of overvaluation. Was it worth $105 billion market capitalization it gained from its initial public offering? What are people talking about?
So there are a couple of things with that. One is that it's really too early to tell how this will pan out. Traditionally, stock price has varied a lot after a public, right, immediately after a company goes public. Another thing is that there was some sort of buzz that, you know, this would take off. There was a guy who crowdsourced predictions on Twitter, and about 2,000 people submitted their predictions for what the closing price would be on the opening day, mm-hmm. and their average was $54. So there was a lot of hype, I guess, about this taking off, and, you know, tremendously, and that obviously didn't pan out. But having a share price hold steady right after an IPO isn't necessarily a bad thing. There's been some speculation about whether or not it was what caused it. Mm-hmm. But it could be just that they set the right price.
Okay. So kind of like when you're selling a house, you know, you can overprice it and it won't sell.
Right.
Or you can put it where it will. Critics are questioning whether the company generates enough advertising revenue to justify being priced at 108 times its earnings over the last 12 months. Any sense about that?
Yeah, so Facebook revenue is $3.7 billion in 2011, and obviously that's like, you know, more than 25 times it is what its valuation is. And that's obviously not based just solely on its income. People thought that there'd be a huge demand for stock, and that's what drove up the valuation.
Some people were trying to get through and couldn't get through to buy stock yesterday, or Friday, I should say, possibly yesterday, but I think it was more a Friday issue. Did that affect things much? I heard that it really didn't. It was just sort of an cosmetic problem.
Yeah, that's one of the things people point to as to why the stock tanked. Nasdaq took an extra 30 minutes to get it trading, and a lot of people, like you said, had problems. And they've actually, humbly apologized for that and agreed to pay some traders for value that they think they've missed.
So for folks that really don't understand all this kind of stuff, why did Facebook go public in the first place? What was the motivation to do it?
A company goes public because they want to raise money. And so there are lots of reasons for raising money. Obviously, Facebook has a lot of growth to do in mobile, and it's acquiring things. And its revenue is $3.7 billion, which is a lot, but to continue growing, you want to bring more money in.
So who should this matter to? For instance, Facebook employees, does this matter a lot to them, or are they going to stick with it, or prospective employees for that matter?
I mean, it may change the company. Now Facebook has to make money. Legally, it has to try to make money, which could, you know, change some of the decisions that they're making. And as far as who's affected immediately, I think there are, you know, the top guys obviously have a little bit more of their net worth. But I don't think the everyday employee is necessarily immediately affected.
Do you think it affects the valuations of other internet companies?
During the first day of trading, a lot of other social media companies' share price did tank a little bit. but it's not really clear exactly why that is.
How long do you think that the Facebook thing, the IPO, is going to be a story? I mean, will it go away and no one will talk about it in a few weeks?
It's definitely already been way more of a story than your typical company. And I think a lot of that is that people are looking at it, you know, kind of to see whether this idea that it's so valuable can hang on, and that a company that makes nothing and its main value is just holding people together and mapping social relationships for advertisers, whether that kind of company can sustain value. So I think people will use it as kind of a benchmark of that.
We were talking about Facebook every week, it seems like, but it's been in the news recently because of its acquisition of Instagram. What will the IPO status do to Instagram's value, for example?
So Instagram, Facebook agreed to acquire it for $300 million plus, you know, so many shares. And so as Facebook's valuation kind of goes up and down, so does Instagram, so does the value of that deal. And then that deal actually hasn't happened yet. The FTC is still investigating whether or not they're going to let that go through, which is a normal thing to do for a deal of that size.
And the value of it, though, it stays the same? It has to?
So the value of it would change because it's $300 million plus, I think, you know, however many million shares of stock. So depending on how valuable that stock is,
right,
the deal may be worth $1 billion as Facebook intended it to be, or it could be worth more, it could be less, depending on how valuable the share portion of that deal is.
My guest is Sarah Kessler. She's a features writer with Mashable. We're talking about the world of Facebook. The latest iteration is its IPO last Friday. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kelly on Facebook says this issue happened because of overhype. She says it will all calm down and be fine soon, which is pretty much what you were saying, right, Sarah?
Yeah, I'd like to believe that.
This past weekend was huge for Mark Zuckerberg. He not only got married, but he also became one of the richest people in the world, or pretty close up. Where is he? Where does he stand right now on that list?
I have not looked today,
okay.
But on Friday he started as, I think, the 29th richest person in the world, which is above Google's founders, and this is by net worth. But then, you know, within a few hours, because Facebook opened at, I think, 42, within a few hours he had dropped back down to 29. So he's still below Jeff Bezos, but above Google founders.
Which has really very little meaning to most of us, I suppose. But
yeah, you know, it's a few extra billion.
Exactly. You wrote about rumors surfacing that Facebook could become the first trillion-dollar company. Speaking of just another billion, but you think it's a premature notion, you said. Why so?
So that's something that actually it was reported that Facebook was telling its new employees that it wanted to be the first trillion-dollar company. And it's something that is kind of hinted at one of Mark Zuckerberg's favorite phrases. He always says that the company is only 1% finished, and his employees will say that their projects are only 1% finished. And it's immature because it's only a $100 billion company at the moment. As determined by how people are buying shares. And so a trillion is a lot further than that. Apple right now is the most valuable company in the world. And obviously their revenues are a lot bigger. And so I guess it depends on whether or not they can really continue to grow at a rate that is similar to what they've grown in their early years, which isn't really the normal path for a mature company to take.
Let's talk to Ken in Worthington. You're on the air, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I've been on Facebook for maybe 4 or 5 years when everybody else was joining. And I'm only on Facebook because all my friends got on Facebook. But as soon as the friends stopped posting pictures and stopped using Facebook, and I have over 300 friends, it lost its appeal. So I switched to Twitter, and Basically, now I just check it maybe once a week to see if somebody's left me a message, but I don't really look at it. I was talking to my friends in my office, and how are they going to sell advertising when people just go on Facebook for 2 seconds and they don't even look anywhere else but where their messages are? So I used to work for a software company that grew very quickly, and everybody said, you know, the sky was the limit, we could keep growing, and all of a sudden it flopped. It's a domino effect that as soon as the network of people that you're on stop using it, then you stop using it, and it loses its value. I'm sure it's growing in users because in the rest of the world, people are still catching on. But as far as my network of friends, I hardly see anybody posting, and it's always usually the same person posting. So now I'm like, I don't even want to log on because it's that same person posting again, what they ate, where they went. I mean, you know, so it's annoying. So it's losing its appeal because the people that are using it are, the ones that are using it are abusing it. They're on there all the time. And then the people like me who are buyers who would actually look at the advertising and be able to buy things, we're annoyed by it and switch to Twitter, which is a quicker way of getting information around. So I just wanted to comment on, see if Ms. Kessler would comment on what could happen if there's a domino effect, just like you have with the AOL and with the e-commerce back in the late 1990s, where they thought, oh, this is just going to grow and grow and grow, and then all of a sudden they were all gone.
Sarah Kessler?
I mean, 900 million active users is nothing. It's a pretty big accomplishment, but the growth rate has been slowing down as far as how many, the percentage growth of users that they see every quarter, which is somewhat to be expected when you get to 900 million. As far as whether or not it'll be useful, they are coming up with new ways to do that. So right now they're kind of positioned as a place where they own the social graph. They know that you're connected to whoever. And having that information, whether or not you go to the site and actually look at all the ads, is valuable because they allow everybody else, the service, to depend on them for that information. So you might, you know, use a fitness app that tracks how you run. And when you sign in using Facebook, it tells you who else is on the fitness app and how fast they're running and when they're running. And so even if you're not going to the site every day, you're still maybe using Facebook.
Sarah Kessler, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. My pleasure.
Sarah Kessler, she's a features writer with Mashable. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation about Facebook and start talking about Facebook and privacy, get in a little bit more detail. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
President Obama described this week's nuclear talks with Iran as a last chance for diplomacy and warns that all options remain on the table. Some say sanctions are working. Give them more time. Others argue enough carrots, it's time for sticks. I'm Neil Conan, talking with Iran. What's the goal? Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 63 degrees in downtown Columbus, a mix of sun and clouds today and a high of 74. There is a slight chance of an isolated shower or thunderstorm this afternoon. Cloudy skies for tonight, a low of 55 degrees. Mostly sunny for Wednesday and a high of 81, partly cloudy Wednesday night, a low of 60.
Support for 89.7 comes from Lenovo on Long Condos, offering homeownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring a diverse community with a mix of historic and newly built homes and condos. Details at homeportohio.org/Lenovo on Long.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Facebook and privacy, never the two shall meet. Or is there a way to walk the walk of Facebook and talk the talk of personal privacy? Joining us now to talk about that is Jeff Fox. Jeff is the technology editor at Consumer Reports, where since 2004, he has edited the annual Consumer Reports State of the Net investigative report, including the 2010 report, Social Insecurity, which exposed the risks posed by social networks such as Facebook. Welcome to the show, Jeff Fox.
Hi, how you doing, Ann?
You know, pretty good. Although I mentioned earlier before we went on the air, every time I think that another privacy issue regarding Facebook has reared its ugly head, there's always another surprise around the corner. So some people are sharing too much. That's one problem right off the bat. They just share too much. And I'm wondering, is it too much or just too much of certain information?
I think it's too much of certain information. I mean, I think there's certain kinds of conversations, the things you can have that are probably innocuous. And if you want to talk about what you had for lunch or something like that, you know, people constantly putting pictures up of like shows they went to or talking about restaurants they like. I mean, that's pretty innocent stuff. But I mean, health issues, other very, very personal stuff, is much more sensitive.
I was surprised early on a couple years ago, 3-4 years ago, when I first got on, someone kept complaining about their job, and that came to a screeching halt after about 3 or 4 months. You don't want to be complaining about your job.
I mean, there were incidents, where people didn't realize that their boss was like one of their Facebook friends, and they came to greatly regret that.
Well, also that people, I don't know how much this has changed, but friends of yours can share stuff that you have with friends of theirs.
Yeah, and we found that for a lot of people had the experience of sharing something with just their friends and then having their friends turn around and share it more widely. And there's actually nothing you can do about that except pick better friends.
Mm-hmm. Or decide when you can have different categories of friends too, right?
Yeah, you can have like close friends and maybe acquaintances and things like that. But you don't have any control. People can cut and paste. People can do screenshots or just plain snitch. So it's not, in some respects, it's no different than the physical world.
Privacy controls are an option, but a lot of people don't even know about them. And I try to go back regularly and check the privacy controls to see if there's any changes. It is shocking, though, how many people don't do anything with the privacy controls.
Yeah, I mean, our survey found at least 13 million people in the United States had not never used the privacy controls. Some of them don't think they need it. Some of them didn't know about it. Some people maybe found it too complicated to deal with.
Do you think it's too complicated to deal with? What's the Consumer Reports assessment of that?
I'll speak from my own experience. Mm-hmm. In the investigation that we did, and as a Facebook user, some parts of it I find fairly easy to follow, and then there are parts of it, like for example, tagging. I've read the descriptions over and over again about what tagging is and how it works, and if you ever read that stuff, after a while, your eyes glaze over trying to understand it. On the other hand, something really simple like, do I want to keep my birth date private or things like that, they're not that hard to do once you go into the privacy controls.
My guest is Jeff Fox. He is the technology editor at Consumer Reports. We're talking about privacy and Facebook. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page if you want, and you can tweet me at @AnnFisherWOSU. So this is one of those things I didn't know about. Even if you don't click the Facebook like button at a site, say it's the New York Times or, your favorite restaurant or whatever it is, Facebook knows you've been there. How can that be? Is that true even if you aren't a Facebook user? Because I never push the Facebook I like buttons because I don't want Facebook to know everywhere I've been.
Yeah, I think it's even true even if you're not a Facebook user. Though if you're not a Facebook user, they'd certainly know a lot less about you. But By a site putting a like button on their site, they have essentially established, a communication link, with Facebook. Because if you click on the like button, if you did click on the like button, there would be, it would go up on your Facebook page. So there's a linkage there. But those sites know the information they send back to Facebook include, let's say, the time and date that you visited and your internet address, which is known as your IP address, which might identify your physical location. They might not know the, if you weren't signed into Facebook, they might not know the name of the person that actually visited the site, mm-hmm. but they would still know some things about it.
And U.S. online privacy laws, and this has been reported about extensively now because of what's going on in China and so forth, but U.S. online privacy laws are weaker than those in Europe and much of the world. And I wondered, how are they weaker? What should we know about the U.S. privacy laws?
In Europe, they have there's something called opt-out and opt-in. I mean, opt-out is where something is sort of assumed that they can collect things unless you say don't. But an opt-in is where a site doesn't collect information unless you say it's okay. There's a big difference. And in the U.S., for the most part, opt-out, which is the version that's kind of weaker, that tends to collect information, is kind of the way things work here. And in Europe, it's the other way around, and that they kind of have to ask for permission all the time. Also in Europe, users have the right by law in the EU to request all the information that a site like Facebook actually collects about them. And as of now, that's still not true here.
What can you get from Facebook?
They have a system now where you can download a fair amount of the stuff, in your Facebook account, which includes your photos and some of your personal information. As our story was coming out, and as there was a lot of news about this a couple of weeks ago going on in Europe, Facebook began increasing, the amount of information that they would give people. But they still have, for example, the time and date of every single time you've signed in to the service, the internet address, friend requests you've made, and other information like that, which you don't normally see when you use the service. You wouldn't know they had that, from looking at your account.
Kathy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Kathy.
Hi. I have a question about when a friend asked me to give them my birth date so that they can put that in their calendar. Where does that go and who can see it? Is it just the friend that's asking for that sees that?
They want to put it in their Facebook calendar?
That's what they're saying. Yeah, they want to, I guess, somehow have that information so when my birthday comes around, it pops up and they can then post happy birthday to me.
I've had a lot of people asking me that. It's the same question from everybody. It must be some Facebook thing.
Yeah.
If you make your birth date available to all your friends, it will pop up on all of their Facebook pages, and you'll get 45 happy birthdays on your birthday.
Right, but it's in
addition. You don't have to actually give it to them.
But they're asking anyways. Why would they be doing that?
Right, exactly. Yes.
I'm not familiar with what happens with someone else's calendar, but if somebody asked me to do that, the first thing I would do is find out how that feature works first, mm-hmm. understand that if I do give it to them, I would try it in my own account, try to put in a birth date for a friend myself and see how protected it really is. Mm-hmm. And if you think the protections are good and you really trust this friend, maybe you want to do that. First thing I do is always try to understand how a feature works.
I'm being told that it's called My Calendar Birthday Request. It's a Facebook app.
Oh, it's an app.
Yeah.
And once you're getting into third-party apps, you're definitely treading on the thinner ice because depending on what permissions the app the app developer is another company whose privacy practices you may not even know about. So your risks there immediately are much greater that information is going to get out to somebody else.
Thanks,
question.
Kathy.
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Jeff Fox, technology editor at Consumer Reports. We're talking about privacy and Facebook. Is there such a thing? Give us a call if you have a question, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Something interesting that I got from the respondents in your online survey of, I guess it's 2002 households, a lot of people falsify their information on Facebook. Consumer Reports reported that 25% of the respondents said that they're faking it. That's up 10% from 2 years ago.
Yeah, we started asking that a couple of years ago, and back then it was 10%, and then the next year it was 15%, and now 25%, which, kind of my eyes opened when I saw that, because a lot of times we track trends to see how things change over time, And it appears that people are engaging in self-defense there, I think.
Right, and sometimes people are just trying to create, there's different people that want to face, be a friend on Facebook with me. I don't know them. And if they don't have a picture even, but I don't know if anything of what they're putting down is true.
No, and you don't even know who they – I mean, our survey showed that there were a lot of people who feel that some of the people in their friends list they either don't know well enough to trust, or even if they – or if they do know them, they don't feel completely comfortable with them. When you start getting beyond – I don't know too many people that actually have 100 or 200 close friends.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get beyond a small circle – and friends of friends is even worse. If you're going to make anything available to friends of friends, you might as well make it public, because friends of friends typically can number in the tens of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm. Dave and Bexley, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hi. I signed up for Facebook, but I don't see the value of it. How do I get off?
Actually, the delete your account link, which is there, but, they don't make it, really obvious how to do it. On our website at consumerreports.org, if you go to this, we have this whole story available for free right now. There's a section on Facebook tips. And one of those tips actually has a live link directly to the delete my account feature in Facebook. So if you really want to do it, go to our tips on our website, and you can get right to the page that does it.
It's consumerreports.org?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Dave.
Consumer Reports member?
No, this is this whole story, because it's a public service. It's not a ratings of TVs or cars. Is available right now. It's available to everyone for free. You don't have to be a member.
Okay.
So we wouldn't mind if you subscribe.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks.
Last year, Jeff Fox, German regulators considered action against Facebook's facial recognition feature, saying that it violates German privacy laws by collecting users' biometric data without their explicit consent. Now, that gets into that whole opt-in or opt-out issue, but what is Facebook doing with facial recognition feature?
And that's something they call tag suggest. So
okay.
People use Facebook. If you see tag suggest, that's facial recognition. It's a kind of innocuous sounding name. But what they're doing is the idea was to make it easier for your friends when they post pictures. People often like to tag their friends as to who's in what picture. But they made an automated system where if Facebook gets a picture of you and records enough information about your face, that when your friends post pictures that you're in, it would automatically suggest to them to tag it, supposedly saving them the effort. But in the process, it's allowing Facebook to, amass a very large database of descriptions of people's faces. Facebook already has 60 billion photos, and they say that users are adding 250 million a day. And just recently, they bought a photo sharing service called Instagram that will add even more. So this is a concern. I mean, if the government was building a database with everyone's face in it, I think people would be concerned. So I don't think if one company is amassing, a database like that, it's any less of a concern.
Let me get this straight. Just by my looks, they're doing tag suggest?
Yes. It looks at a picture and a photo, and then it kind of does a numerical calculation based on the shape of the eyes, the distance between the eyes, nose, and ears, and it has enough information. By the way, this is one reason why we suggest for people for their profile photo, they might want to use a cartoon character or a baby picture or of themselves or something other than just a straight, headshot.
Right. Okay.
So you could turn the feature off. And again, our tips on our website tell people how to turn that off if you don't want that to happen.
Okay. Dave in Grove City, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, you.
Okay, we had an issue with my wife's Facebook account. It said that we were locked out because someone had tried to access the account in South America, and we were requested to change passwords. I just wondered if that's indication of a bigger problem, or we just change our information and I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, it's hard to know offhand. I mean, if it happens again, then there's some problem going on, and it might be whether it's someone you know or someone was spying on you or something. But if you change the password and you change it to a really strong password and you don't tell anybody the password, nobody should be able to get into the account. And if that happens again, it could be that you've either been tricked. I mean, there's a lot of scams on Facebook now, not on Facebook itself, but people are posting links to things which trick people into disclosing their passwords. So you really have to be careful. You know, it's hard to say from what you said exactly how somebody got hold of it. Again, if it wasn't a very difficult password to guess, somebody might have gotten it that way. But more likely, someone disclosed it.
Okay, Dave.
Yes.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Take care. Bye. Location sharing can be a problem. You brought that up earlier. You said if it's just at your favorite restaurant. But what about when we're talking about what restaurant we're at, while we're at it with certain friends, and you're tagging the friends, and everybody knows where these three people are now. They're not at home.
I mean, the privacy issues. I mean, one is, of course, people know you're not at home. So you know, if somebody was wanting to do something at your home, they would know that. It's probably, if you're just out for dinner and you're going to be back in an hour or two, I'd say the risk is probably minimal. But we found that almost 5 million people had disclosed, you know, on their Facebook page travel plans. Mm-hmm. And if that means being away for longer than a short time, you're at greater risk. If you say, I'm going to be away the next 2 weeks, you know, you're creating a much bigger window of risk than let's say you just went out for a snack.
And there have been documented cases of insurers scouring Facebook to fight fraud, and I guess to figure out if someone is maybe working when they said they are disabled or something like that. There might also be danger in liking certain pages that suggest that you might have certain illnesses or that kind of thing.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the biggest things we came across was that the very many people who put stuff on their Facebook wall or timeline leave it as public. And that is one of the biggest risks that people are unwittingly taking. And there's a simple thing. You can, again, find that on our website. There's a simple thing you can take that takes about 30 seconds and three clicks, and it will take essentially everything you've said on Facebook since you opened your account and convert it over to just your friends. If you do that, insurance companies, the IRS, and any other criminals, any other nosy person was immediately locked out. And I'm really hoping that a lot of people do this, because the worst thing you can do is leave all your conversations public. And it's very easy to do on Facebook.
Well, Jeff Fox, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Sure.
Jeff Fox, he's technology editor for Consumer Reports. Coming up, our gadget guy, Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Necessarily so.
On the next Fresh Air, David Alan Grier. He's nominated for a Tony for his performance as Sportin' Life in Porgy and Bess. Grier first became known for his work on the sketch comedy show In Living Color. Join us.
Won't you tell us more?
Now little David was small, but oh my.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And join us for All Sides tomorrow morning at 11, the role of women in the Catholic Church going forward. That's a discussion from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for Tech Tuesday comes from Soho Tech, providing computer consulting services to residential and small business customers. More information at 323-4085 or online at sohotechcolumbus.com.
The WOSU member card benefit of the month for May is the Gateway Film Center. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission all month long. Become a basic $60 member and get your member card by going to WOSU.org right now. 64 degrees in downtown Columbus, a mix of sun and clouds today, with a slight chance of an isolated shower or thunderstorm this afternoon, a high of 74. Clouds for tonight, a low of 55 degrees. Sunshine and a nice day on Wednesday, a high of 81. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Every week, every day, there is not only something new under the sun, but when it comes to technology and gadgets, there's too much new under the sun. Joining us today to talk about just a few of those things, as he does every week, is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Let's talk about Eye on the Road. The makers of Eye on Road, say they want to turn your smartphone from the number one distraction on the road to the number one driving assistant. What is Eye on Road?
So this actually kind of threw me a little bit when I first went to try it out. It is a it is an application that is designed to encourage you to take your phone and put it in your windshield using a mount, you know, a window mount like you would for GPS, so that your camera can see the road, and it actually takes the information from the camera and uses it to provide you with additional information about your driving experience.
Okay. Such as it, one of the things it does is the advanced collision warning system. Couldn't that in and of itself get a bit distracting if it's wrong once in a while?
So I actually tested this on the drive that I did from Baltimore to New Orleans for CTIA. We had it set up in the car, and I kind of gave it a feel. And what it really does, it takes the camera and it uses it as kind of a range finder, where if you are more than, say, a car length away from a car, it'll alert you. It's not a very obnoxious alert. It's something that, you know, given 1 or 2 minutes to really adjust to the application, you become familiar with it enough that you're not constantly staring at it. It just makes a short, you know, chirp to let you know that you're getting pretty close to that vehicle in front of you, and you know, gives you actual numbers of range as far as how far away in feet you are from that vehicle, so that you can you know, adjust your driving to match that. Now, the only time that becomes kind of annoying is when you're in actual traffic and you can't help but be, you know, 15 feet from the car in front of you. But when you're, you know, highway driving or something like that, I actually found it to be pretty helpful.
Now, we're going to get some more of the elements on Eye on Road, but when you turn, can you turn it off, and can you, when you turn it off, do you turn off all of the different elements, you know, the advanced collision warning system and the safety point counter, for instance, and we'll get to that in a second, but, or can you, do you have to turn everything off, or can you turn off just pieces of it?
It's got a lot of settings that allow you to control how notifications happen, and that helps a lot of things. The problem that you run into is that you can't really make any of these changes while you're driving. So you really, it becomes a, you know, test and correct and test and correct. So you can make a lot of these changes. You can remove certain elements of the experience from the app and, you know, kind of customize it to your driving desire. But it's not something you're going to be doing in real time. You're going to drive to the grocery store and be like, well, I really don't like that feature. And so you have to turn it off so that it's not there the next time you drive. If you try and change it and, you know, while you're driving, that's a bad idea.
So this is another augmented reality experience, in this case, driving experience. Tell us again what the augmented reality means.
Augmented reality in this definition takes what you could see and overlays information on top of it, you know, that it's from the digital world. The best example of how this works for Eye on Road is actually the lane finder. While you're driving, it actually takes the camera, it can see the lanes on the road, and it paints a green zone in the app that you can see, and if your car begins to drift out of that green zone, it'll warn you if you're moving out of lanes, much in the same way that a sound map on a road would if you're, you know, going into the shoulder.
Safety point counter. I thought this was kind of interesting. The safety point counter, it keeps track of when you do good things?
It does keep track of when you do good things, when you distance yourself appropriately from a vehicle in a certain amount of time, or if you've traveled a certain distance without, merging or accidentally, you know, dropping out of your lane or something like that. There's a lot of things that it keeps the track of and gives you feedback on your driving experience.
So that sounds like something great for instance, a new driver.
It's perfect for a new driver, as long as, you know, the noises that come from the app and the constant desire to want to look at the app don't become too distracting.
Okay. My guest is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question or comment for Russell, we're talking about Eye on Road right now, but you can ask him anything. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to the Facebook page or tweet me at Ann Fisher WOSU. Yeah, that was a, again, we'll get to some more of those features, but this app has so many features. Does the number of features take away from the overall quality, do you think?
No, and it really has a, you know, it has an out-of-the-box experience that I found really pleasing, where you can just turn it on and let it go, and it gives you a lot of information. It's really something that, you know, it's really beneficial to, you know, drive around for a little bit and fine-tune to your driving experience. But even just the out-of-box experience, it doesn't have every feature turned on, but the set that it does, you know, especially the lane guide and the rangefinder and things like that are really, I found to be very beneficial, you know, as long as it's not too distracting. I know a couple of drivers, you know, personally who couldn't stand to have, you know, a flashing screen or you know, something like that just outside of their visual spectrum when they're driving. So it's really personal preference as far as how it gets used.
I like the car locator.
Yeah, the car locator is fun.
Tell us about that.
That's not new. There have been a couple of car locator apps for Android and for iPhone and Windows Phone. Basically, you know, when you get out of your car, you pin your location on a map, and it you know keeps track of it when you go into a mall or something like that, and when you leave. You can go right back to the app and there's a, you know, find my car button and it just, you know, points it out to you on the map. And that's something that, you know, has been around for a little while, but having it integrated into the app is very nice. I did note that you're using now, when you have all of this on, your screen is on all the time and your GPS is now on all the time and you're doing your cameras on all the time. So this is not something that you can do without power unless you really just don't like your phone's battery.
So you can just plug it in though, right in the car?
Oh yeah, if you plug it in the car, then you'll be fine, but you pretty much have to do that. It's not really optional if you're going to use this.
Well, speaking of the camera issue, there's the Road Snapshot Assistant too. This is very directly related to the camera. What's that about? When would you use that?
So this is using, you know, the camera all the time. It's constantly, it's almost like it's recording a video all the time but not saving it. And if you've got, you know, the camera within arm's reach, preferably if you've got a passenger in the car, but if you do feel like you're able to multitask on that level, you can actually reach up and tap the button and grab a screenshot of whatever's in front of you. So maybe someone has cut you off or, you know, you see a vehicle on the side of the road or something like that. You can actually grab take a picture, you know, using the camera on your phone, and then you have, you know, you have the information there. You have a license plate if you need it. You know, it just gives you the ability to grab that information very quickly. And you can reach up and tap the button, and it takes the picture and moves it aside, and it goes right back to the app in a second. So it's not very distracting at all.
I love bumper stickers, and I always forget what they are.
That's perfect. That is the perfect way to do that.
There's the headway distance monitoring and alert. Is that the same thing as advanced collision?
It's similar. I will admit that I didn't get a whole lot of time with this particular feature, but what it basically does is it uses range finding in vertical instead of horizontal. So if you are traveling somewhere and your vehicle, may be too tall for that area.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Driver friendly phone operation, which that's not new.
No, and this is really just their way of saying that, you know, if they feel like from their test it's safe enough to use while you're driving. There are applications out there that do a lot of different clever things for the car that, you know, when the application says pretty specifically when you open it that it's preferable that a passenger be the one using these features in the car. And this is just their way of saying that, you know, they feel like it's safe that the driver use it.
The personal web dashboard, what does that look like?
It's really just a quick glimpse. If you've got, you know, a couple of websites that are your favorite or your things like that, it gives you a glimpse, you know, like maybe you're stopped at a long stoplight or something like that. It gives you a quick shot at some information to help you pass the time.
Once again, I'm talking with Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. We are right now talking about the Eye on Road. We'll turn our sights to the Asus Pad phone if we have time, and then we'll also get to some emails or some from some listeners. One thing I've read that one of its biggest problems is that it does not work at night. Why is that?
So it uses your camera, and if your camera doesn't have a very good backlit sensor, like maybe let's say some of the lower end Android devices, or even really the iPhone, you know, doesn't have a particularly good camera to take pictures of things at night, especially, you know, at any kind of distance. So you would really need a phone with a backlit camera sensor, like maybe the HTC One or something like that, that would work well at night to be able to actually determine things like range and stuff like that. It's a limitation of the current technology of cameras and phones.
It recently won a CTIA Wireless eTech Award, which must be a pretty big deal. The award scored high marks in innovation, functionality, technological importance, implementation, and overall wow factor. But I wonder, what's the typical user saying about it? Do they agree?
So I've yet to meet an actual user that wasn't, you know, prompted by either myself or you know, one of my colleagues to use the application. But from what I've seen, everyone that I've introduced the app to, it's been a great, you know, add on if they've, you know, if they feel comfortable taking the phone and, you know, mounting it in the car in such a way that it's kind of, you have to be careful where you put it in the car, and it requires a lot of customization. So they're the specific group of people who are going to take advantage of this app are going to be people who really want that extra information and are willing to tweak it until it works for them.
Email from a listener. What's the best free texting app for Android phones?
The best free texting app. If you're not using Google Voice, which I would definitely recommend, then there's also Viber. It's V-I-B-E-R. But both of those are free texting apps. Viber's kind of limited, and it requires that the other person also have Viber installed. But Google Voice is free for you know, just about anybody.
And then an email from Sarah asks, I am new to having a smartphone. I just got my first iPhone and data plan through Verizon. I got the plan that allows 2 gigs of use a month. How do I know how much I am using? For the past 2 months, I have used a 1 gig. What would it take for me to accidentally go over my data plan?
The biggest thing you can do to accidentally go over your data plan is to be watching movies or listening to music. You know, those are two things that you know, accidentally take up a lot of data, you know, especially movies, because they're, you know, there's a lot going on there. But I wouldn't say really that for most people, 2 gigs is going to be a big thing. If memory serves, the Verizon account service actually has a tool that allows you to track throughout the month how much data you're using. The iPhone doesn't have anything built into it that does that, but there are probably some good apps. If you look for, you know, data usage, you know, in the App Store, you'll probably find a good free app that'll track it.
So let's turn to the Asus Pad phone, tablet, laptop, all in one.
This excites me so much. I've gotten a couple of minutes with it, and this is the problem that I run into, Anne, is that I play with all these gadgets, and so I pick up, you know, a tablet, and I go to a website, and then I pick up a phone, and you know, maybe I've forgotten what URL I go to, and there's a couple of ways that I can go around that. But the Pad phone makes it all one device. You know, my laptop, my tablet, and my phone are all one gadget, and they do this by making the phone this adaptable thing that you stick in all of these devices to make them, you know, the extension of that phone. So I take, you know, the Pad phone, the phone, and there's actually a slot in the tablet accessory that the Pad phone comes with that you stick the phone into, and now you have a tablet that has all of the information that your phone had because your phone is inside of it.
Why do you need this, Russell?
It's one of these things where it keeps, you know, it's one device. It's one set of information. It's one, you know, one thing to track. There's one power cord. There's one. It takes all of these different things. You know, because I walk around, I usually have a laptop if I need to do some writing. I have a tablet, especially if I'm walking through a city like New York or something like that. I can take advantage of the larger map and not get lost every 10 minutes, like I'm really prone to do in New York. And you know, my phone, you know, obviously, so I can make phone calls and communicate with the people that I work with. But to be able to have all of these devices not just communicate with one another, but be the same device, just is incredibly functional. You know, I can take that laptop, and it has a keyboard accessory that I can now take that tablet, you know, sized thing. It's like taking an iPad and sticking it onto a keyboard with a trackpad. And now my phone and my tablet are now, you know, together in my laptop. And I can still do things like answer calls and, you know, it's just a single device. And that's where I see its function.
Some folks maybe find that it's too bulky. Is it big?
It's not very big. It's certainly the tablet mount is certainly going to be bigger than the iPad. You know, the iPad is definitely designed to be as thin as possible and as sleek as possible. And when you think about taking a phone and sticking it inside a tablet, there's an obvious necessity there for it to be a little bigger. But it's not really a whole lot bigger than an iPad, and it's still just as light. And the battery life on this thing is really phenomenal. And that's another thing that is really important to me is, you know, having a battery that's going to last through the day no matter what I do to it.
I was surprised there's a problem with compatibility with other Asus products.
Yeah, it's one of those things, you know, that this is, you know, it's not designed to work with things like, you know, some of the Asus accessory line hasn't really been optimized for it yet. And that makes a lot of sense because it doesn't run things like Windows or, you know, So these accessories are not going to function in quite the same way.
It was released in Taiwan over a year ago, but has yet to be released in other markets. What's the delay? When will we get it in the U.S.?
So they announced it in Taiwan a year ago. It's still on its way to Taiwan.
Okay.
There are a couple of people in Taiwan that have their hands on it. But it is going. They do plan on bringing it here to the U.S. within the next couple of months. And the biggest thing there is that, you know, there's network, you know, issues that go in there. You know, we have some really incredibly fast and powerful wireless networks here in the U.S. now with things like LTE. And these devices, when they come to the U.S., if they don't have LTE, nobody buys them anymore. So they really have to kind of optimize for the kind of usage that the United States is going to offer it.
Now, there's rumors of a second version already in the works. Is that possibly what they're planning for the United States?
It's more than likely that that's what's going to happen to the United States. In order to create an LTE version, they probably had to, you know, adjust, you know, how it's designed a little bit to include the LTE radio.
If you could improve it in any way, what would you do, Russell?
If I could improve it in any way, I would probably make it easier to hook up to something like a, you know, a television or something like that to kind of add some additional functionality to it.
And what about the price? What are we looking at here?
There have been a lot of different speculation as far as prices. You know, the translation right now from, you know, dollars to euros is that it would be, you know, including the phone, the tablet, and the laptop dock would be around $900, and which is certainly comparable to what you would pay for a higher-end laptop right now. But there's, you know, there's carrier subsidy to keep in mind. You know, we get a lot of phones here in the U.S. that are only $199 and $299 on a contract, and we'll see similar pricing here in the U.S. for that device.
Well, Russell, thank you so much. We didn't get to everything today. Maybe next week we'll talk about security systems for our
homes. That sounds like fun.
All right. Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media. From the